Five, four, three, two, one.
It's the new Panic Room Radio Show, brought to you by Hellbound Books Publishing. Experience publishers of horror, noir, bizarro, and all things dark in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. You can find us at www.hellboundbooks.com. But first, get your feet up and enjoy the show.
Central on the 30th of November, which means tomorrow it's open season on Christmas trees. So and around here, people have still, some have probably still got them up from last year, but trees are going up and it's just, it's like Christmas threw up around here. It's terrible. And I'm under pressure from the kids to get our tree put up. So bah humbug is what I say, but no doubt this time next week we'll have a tree in the corner of the living room, which is great. This year, artificial one this year, so I don't have all the depression of something dying in the corner of the house. So anyway, speaking of Christmas, and I know it's her favourite time of the year, here's Xtina. A merry almost Christmas. How are you? Bloody Christmas. What is going on? The problem is now, and again, I found speaking as an alien to the colonies. Thanksgiving is like that's the trigger for Christmas, and now it's like everybody's on fucking wind down, and it's just
yeah.
When I was a kid, you know, Christmas didn't start. You break up for school, like, you would get 2 weeks off. You break up, like, a week before. The tree would go up the weekend before Christmas. And that was it. But now it starts before Thanksgiving because you get all the Christmas stuff. Literally, as soon as the kids go back to school in August, the Christmas shit's in the shops. But now you have Thanksgiving, and then literally everyone's on wind down. It's like everybody takes a month off, trying to get things done, trying to get decisions from people. It's just like, oh my goodness me, I mean, even us. I mean, to be fair, with Hellbound Books, you know, we got all our, 2023 titles are out. They were out a while ago, obviously in time for so we could buy books for Christmas, folks. But not that we're going to take time. I don't have time to wind down. You know, I think it's, and I was speaking to someone else the other week, who also a business owner, and it's like just the opposite because it's the mad dash to get everything finished. I had to tell them how things worked in publishing, as well. I want my book published in time for Christmas. What? I want it published. Okay, so...
Good luck.
Good luck with that. It gets better. No, it's a kid's book, so she wants it illustrating.
Mm. Oh, wow. Yeah.
And she's not started writing it yet. And she wants it out and published in time so people can buy it for Christmas. And
Maybe next Christmas.
Exactly. She didn't specify which Christmas. I mean, because if you started it now, it's certainly been in time for then. But, so there's that sort of, juxtaposition between, it's soon be Christmas and, you can wait till the new year. And then everybody, I want it now. We're stuck in the middle. So for me, business as usual, to be honest. I took a long weekend for Thanksgiving, which was nice, much needed.
Yeah.
I'm gonna take it easy over Christmas break because we've worked bloody hard this year, you and I. In fact, all of Hellbound. Everybody involved with Hellbound Books has worked damn hard.
Definitely. Titles
out, sign up some brilliant authors, make everything perfect. We've done a lot of work behind the scenes as well. It kind of saddens me. We've spent a lot of time and money with SEO companies, getting the website looking, getting the website all sexed up and everything. Because it's all back end, so it looks the same. The website doesn't look any bloody different. But we do. We sort of spent all this money and it looks the damn same. But I know because I've been involved in all the stuff behind the scenes. It looks sexy behind the scenes now, which is great,
I still can't wait for you to put the little Santa hat on our demon. I mean, I'm waiting for that. That's when I know.
That's when it's really Christmas, isn't it? And that's not going to happen till this. I know you'll be next Friday. Tomorrow you'll be. Have you put the hat on the guy yet? Have you put the hat on the guy? I know it'll happen.
Yeah.
I know, but
I'm
holding off. I shall do that. I'll do that early next month. So, which to be fair is almost upon us, and I always get very very introspective this time of year. I really get excited for a whole new year, but I haven't this time last year, and this year's been an absolute pig. I mean, it really has.
Yeah.
There's been some good stuff, but geez, it's like kick me in the balls and then just carried on kicking me all year. So.
Yeah. I think for me, it's just gone by so fast. So it's like, I don't know. It's been a blur. So yes, definitely, we've definitely had some, you know, unpleasantness, definitely. But man, it just seems to have whizzed by, and now I'm sitting here going, oh my God, it's almost December.
Well, I guess that's been the one saving grace. It's been a bit of a shit year, but it's gone fast. So
yeah. That's
but,
true.
You know, business-wise, it's been a very good year. You know, we've got some fantastic titles, great anthologies, great authors out, one of whom we'll be speaking to any minute. So that's kind of kept me going. You know, the thought that, something's going right. It's not all been, you know. So, never know. Next year, there may be, you know, we may be able to follow up Jim's Love Life Corner. you know, if ever I get one, you know, that involves more than just me, obviously.
That would be a great segment.
it would, but wouldn't it be a brilliant segment? And we could interview. We could get you know, the lady of the week on, and we could interview her.
Ooh, could we?
On the show. That would be a great feature. I mean, it probably lasts so long. Before, you know, the previous ladies of the week started listening to the next shows. Then things are going to go south.
Yeah,
pretty damn quickly, I would think.
We'll see. That would be entertaining as well, though.
It would be. Then we could do what we do when we do like a special landmark show and get them all on at once. You know, like have half a dozen of Jimbo's lady friends on who all think that they're the one, and obviously, well, they are a one. You know, it's just special in its own way. But and if any of them are listening tonight, this is all just joke, okay?
Yeah, right.
Just banter. Banter.
Comedy section.
We exaggerate for comic effect. That's what we're doing here. But anyway, before I dig this hole any deeper for myself, what have we got coming up on the show, Xtina?
I am always excited when we have an author or help an author on the show because, you know, we get to talk to them in emails and stuff, but, you know, when we finally get to talk to them live, it's so much fun. So, yeah, our guest of the evening, we have horror author Colin W. Sargent.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, Colin. How are you, sir?
That's great. And thanks for the great welcome. I'm proud to be in the new panic room.
Thank you for joining us. Absolute pleasure. And as I said, you know, well, we've corresponded via email and whatnot, and it's nice to actually finally get to have a chat.
Oh, it is. You know, I've been trying to learn a little bit about you guys as I go, and I realized I went to University of Lancaster for creative writing studies, and that's right on the same parallel as Yorkshire.
Lancaster, yes, Lancaster. It's nice there, actually. It's the wrong side of the Pennines, obviously, but yeah, it is nice.
Yeah, and when I went to University of York for a reading, I learned something that I didn't know at all, the derivation of the word shambles, that it's a neighborhood in New York, and everything started to come together for me. So that was fun. So you're from a beautiful part
fantastic.
Of the world.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I lived in York for a while after my first marriage sort of ended rather abruptly. The shambles, great little street, and you've been there, you know. Anyone listening, I actually featured it in a young adult romance I wrote a couple of years ago. And it's the upper floors sort of... The rooms are like, what, you know, about 6 inches, 8 inches apart. And apparently young lovers used to sort of lean out and smooch in the middle of the night, which I find very romantic. Very
that
romantic.
Is, so that's already been done. I might as well just trash the new chapter I just wrote. And also, I got to go to Dublin, and I learned what beyond the pale means.
Oh, do you know, I don't know that one. Do enlighten us.
Well, there was a wall that went around the city of Dublin, and anybody that was going a little beyond or outside of where it was safe into some place where it wasn't safe is going beyond the pale. So everybody says it, but you can live it if you're from Dublin.
Well, there you go. I've learned something. Thank you. I did not know that.
Well, there's so much I don't know. Flying Dark, the new book that Hellbound has been so kind to give a shot, comes with a cocktail pairing because this is the 21st century.
Yeah, so, I love the premise of the book. I mean, it's the history. It's the obviously you can tell us a bit. Obviously, you know the history and the mix of all of that. Sorry, I'm stealing your thunder. You tell us all about it, Colin.
All right. Well, I was all wound up talking about the cocktail pairing. This is my recipe for a dark and steamy. To be sipped while reading or discussing Flying Dark. Kraken black spiced rum. Mm. 2 teaspoons of brown sugar. 1 pat of softened butter. Boiling water to taste. And that's up to you how much you have to use or not. And I've tried a couple of these, and it's rocket fuel. It's really fun to have them. I got started with this particular story because I live on the coast of Maine, and I was doing a story in 2015 about a house that was for sale on a remote island off the coast of Maine called North Haven Island. And so I went out there, and it was going to be a regular day at the races type of story saying, oh, this place is for sale. And isn't it beautiful? And if you have views of Portugal from here. And I got there, and I learned that it was once a summer home and was built for Dwight Morrow. And that's former Ambassador Dwight Morrow. And he was a partner at J.P. Morgan. So he was quite the plutocrat. Early in the last century, but he was also the ambassador to Mexico. And that was all nice. It was all sort of pedestaled for oblivion, and I got that exposition into the story okay. But then when I came to visit the house, a lone eagle flew over the top of the house, which is called Deacon Brown's Point. And the eagle swirled around, and then kind of like a Carlos Castaneda eagle, it swept down and said, you know, there's more to this story than you think. Mm. And so I started checking into it, and I realized that Dwight Morrow's daughter was Anne Morrow, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. And actually, her full name, once she got married, was Anne Morrow Lindbergh. And she was Charles Lindbergh's bride. And when they were married, you know, he was the most famous person on earth because he flew the Atlantic solo just when radio came into its own. So, you know, in the tradition of this show, it was like hooking up a boombox to his kind of narrow set of facts. And everyone thought he was this easygoing, toe-headed young guy from Little Falls, Minnesota, all of which was true. But he was also, and people don't know this about Charles Lindbergh, he had a really, it's not unfair, but he had a head start. He was the son of a 5-term congressman. And not only that, he went to school at Sidwell Friends. And I always thought of him as, you know, part of the American exceptionalism. He was the soul of America. He could make his own breaks. But he was going to school with all the children of presidents. And I think you guys all know the Sidwell friends. Chelsea Clinton went there, and Trisha Nixon, people like that. And so here was this uber-privileged Lindbergh standing in stark contrast to the legend of Lindbergh. And I'm saying, gee, everything needs a new narrative. It's wonderful that fiction can get the message out there and actually the truth out there faster. It's the fastest delivery system for the truth that I know. So anyway, I learned that after they got married, Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh disappeared into thin air. There were thousands and thousands of people snapping pictures of them, and then they vanished. And they went on a secret boat along the coast of Maine up to North Haven Island. And I grew up in Maine, and I didn't know that they spent their summers there every year for decades upon decades. And it just to me is kind of emblematic of the secret life that Lindbergh had as a eugenicist, as a serial serial everything. He had multiple families in Europe, and I just didn't know anything about him. So that was the start when that eagle clued me in, and I started visiting Lindbergh landmarks because coincidences just jump in my lap. And so I'll give you some air to ask me a question if you'd like.
Sorry, I thought Xena was going to talk there. She took a deep breath as if she's going
to... well, you know,
there's a Lindbergh story, obviously.
You know, Christina, I like your poetry, and actually Lindbergh, to use one of your words, infected everyone around him with his personality, which had a lot of dark negatives to it. He smothered people with his innocence.
Wow.
That's an interesting phrase because he sounds very far from innocent. I mean, obviously, I mean, I think everyone is familiar-ish, you know, with the story and all the mystery surrounding it and what have you. But obviously, you've delved far deeper than most. What is it that infected you about Lindbergh?
Well, I have done some delving, and I went to, for instance, when I was traveling through England, and I didn't know how much of Lindbergh had to do with England, but I was doing promotions for a book of mine called The Boston Castrato, whole different story. And then I disappeared from my own book tour, and people asked me, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Long Barn. And Long Barn is south of London, and it's where it was infested with Nazi lovers, including members of the Cliveden set. And when everyone in America was asking questions of Lindbergh and the trial of the century was happening for his kidnapped son, who was killed and found, or supposedly killed and found in an unmarked grave. Charles Lindbergh and Maura Lindbergh went to this perfect, beautiful place south of London that's called, in Kent, called Long Barn. And this was during 1936 to 1938. And so here's an example. I'll just cut open my shock. I grew up loving Jesse Owens, the fantastic Olympic competitor. I ran athletics and track and field, and so he was a hero of mine. And I realized that while Jesse Owens was doing the broad jumps in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, sitting up in the stands, infamously but unknown to me, was Lindbergh, and he was sitting on the Hitler side of the field. In fact, he was sitting so close to Hitler, their comments were audible to each other. And I thought, I just didn't know this. I just completely didn't know this. I also didn't know that Lindbergh was, I knew he was a genius because I was a Navy pilot, and some of the flying that he did is unmatchable. And so he was a savant in flying. But I didn't know that he invented the world's first artificial heart.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't know.
Really?
Yes, he's credited for that. And so it's Yankee ingenuity twisted into pure perversion. It's totally appropriate that Lindbergh's invention of the first artificial heart was a glass heart.
Mm. Wow. I had no idea about that. That's quite something. So he was one of these people, I guess, that pop up from time to time, like Tesla, you know, who are pretty much geniuses at everything they turn their hand to.
That's right. But in the story of Flying Dark, his kidnapped and murdered baby is not his natural son. There was a baby swap, and so my main character named Hunter doesn't even know he's descended from Lindbergh, but he feels these vain, glorious, narcissistic urges and these shooting superiority impulses as he's going through Montauk Public High School in New York. And so he's coming to terms with that, and then later in life, he becomes a person who busts the myths of people who have claims to famous fortunes, like a supposed granddaughter of Coco Chanel's. He is the attorney who says, no, you're not Coco Chanel's granddaughter. You have no claim to this descent, and so you don't get the $35 million. And he becomes famous and wealthy himself, but what he won't tell anyone, not anyone, is that he's believes in his heart that he's the son of Charles Lindbergh, and it haunts him from the first chapter of the book. And when you have a monkey on your back like Charles Lindbergh, who is, as I mentioned, he teamed up with Dr. Alexis Carrel, the Nobel Prize winner, because once you're Lindbergh, you have entree into any place in the world. You know, hello, I'm Charles Lindbergh. Can I meet Babe Ruth? Sure. So anyway, he hooked up with who he thought was the smartest person in the world, but that person saw the weakness in Lindbergh. Dr. Carrel saw that he believed that he was so superior with all of his gifts that the world would be a better place if it were peopled almost exclusively with other little Lindbergh children running around. And there are many, many, and this is the truth, many, many children, and we list them at the end of the book, who are alive now. And I get to talk to his daughter, Reeve Lindbergh, who herself is a famous author. It's just true, and it's a secret. It's a secret that nobody wants to learn because it's so gruesome and so frightening. And when Hunter is trying to figure out to what extent Lindbergh did what he did, and how come how come everyone's complicit with keeping his secrets, he ends up understanding that to save his ruined life, Hunter's ruined life, and his ruined love life as a result of being the not really knowing who his father was, but having these suspicions, he's going to have to do what Lindbergh did himself, and that's to fly alone across the Atlantic. And that's how you try to get the monkey off your back. But how thoroughly is that monkey sitting there? And so he's losing his grip, and he's heading into hell.
Wow, I definitely want to hear more. I think we have an excerpt that we are going to play from part of the audio.
We do. Does it need setting up story-wise?
I believe it's just from the Yeah, I believe it's just from the beginning.
Chapter 3. West Berlin, Federal Republic of Germany. One peak is worth 1,000 instrument cross-checks. There were 7 Cuban restaurants in West Berlin, but once you knew your way around, only one was worth the trouble. Since it was a Tuesday, he and Pia might just slip in for a bite at Havana Sexy, the best of the dives. He grasped the door handle, vibrating with tango music from within. Same old waiter, the leering cod, already yelling La Tropicale to the barkeep as the door wheezed shut behind them. At least he kept his mouth shut as he led the way to the last booth on the left, stepping silently past the tank full of shellfish. In the dusty painting below the black lights, a solitary skier in a gaucho hat stared from his alpine mountaintop, surveying the savage beauty of the gorge below. Strength through joy. The waiter placed the beer in front of Hunter. Pen poised over pad, he turned to Pia. And for the lady? You might want to try the conchichara, Hunter said.
I might, Pia said.
She turned to the waiter.
Daiquiri, please.
When the waiter returned with her drink, she surgically resected the blue plastic marlin from it and tossed it on the table.
This is intriguing. I've never been here before.
She scanned the menu on the chalkboard. This is pretty familiar country to me, Hunter said. He'd forgotten the waiter was still there, waiting. She'll have langosta a la cubana, Hunter said, served hot over rice.
I'm allergic to shellfish, Pia said.
No, you aren't. The waiter looked from one to the other. Pia leaned forward.
That's right. You're sure you know everything about me.
Then what would you like? Hunter asked. She addressed the waiter directly.
I'll have the langosta a la cubana.
Ropa vieja, Hunter said. Anything else? I'll let you know if we want anything more later.
It's a bit early to be talking about we, isn't it?
Pia took a sip of her drink.
Or are you referring to Lindbergh's first autobiography, We? How telling that the couple he's referring to is himself and the spirit of St. Louis.
Hunter couldn't look away. When she opened her eyes, she drove straight through him, in a Porsche 924, maybe? She veered and accelerated, navigating a Cornish cut deep into the Alps. Then she pulled over, slammed the car door shut, and stepped outside, removing a red and white cellophane-wrapped pack of Lucky Strikes. She shook it in front of him.
You just can't get away from it, she said.
He drained half his beer without either of them speaking or needing to speak. What was true for flying was true about life. Any pilot knew the descending order of priority was aviate, navigate, communicate.
Why did you really invite me here? She asked. Don't tell me you have more questions.
Why'd you sign the papers? She exhaled.
Because I was ashamed of myself.
That proves it. Shame is not a Lindbergh trait.
For the me who just wanted the money. She batted her eyes and slipped into a stage persona. But the real reason is, I just wanted a chance to meet you.
Hunter realized he wished this lie were true.
What had gotten into him?
You know, you really are a good actress.
You already know that.
You're free of Lindbergh. Do you know what that's worth?
It doesn't solve my daddy issues.
She looked him right in the eye. You're still working with the independent film? He asked, though he knew she knew he knew the answer. In her lamentable underground farce, Deutsche Tabakgegner, young people dodged bullets racing up dizzy stairways while trying to ban tobacco in Germany against a government conspiracy bent on promoting smoking for the tax revenues. In the chase scene, hapless suits, dressed, unfortunately, like Hunter himself, fired automatic weapons at the Pia character, while two long-haired Greenpeacers assisted her in winding her way through an endless glass building. Cut to the next morning with all three of the young bohemians waking up together, shockingly, before going out for their loathsome jogging, taking deep draughts of young, muscular air. Hunter allowed his eyes to take in her slender form, her inky eye shadows direct from Bertolt Brecht and the Neue Sachlichkeit movement.
Du bist sexy.
Sexy was German slang long before it ever became English.
I saw you lurking about our set last week, she said, before you were you.
What's your movie about?
Must everything be about something? The lobster tails were bright red, curled, hot. Oh, she said, I didn't think the ghost pepper would be so intense. It transforms everything it touches. This is so. I don't think I've ever had Cuban food I've enjoyed so much. You haven't, Hunter said. He idly turned over the top card of the illustrated pack that decorated every table and put it down quickly. He wondered if Pia had seen him glance at it.
Panic Room Radio Show is brought to you by Hellbound Books Publishing, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher, along with links to all of their available works across platforms, at hellboundbookspublishing.com. In the mood for something steamy to read? Check out erotica author Jennifer Lynn at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James and Extina at their respective websites, jameslongmore.com for James and darkpoetprincess.com for Extina. Don't forget to follow The Panic Room on social media. Facebook unofficial, The Panic Room Radio Show, our Vimeo channel with all of our previous shows, the new Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website, www.panicroomradio.com.
Pretend you're happy when you're blue. It isn't very hard to do. And you will find happiness without an end if you pretend. Remember, anyone can dream. And nothing's bad as it may seem.
Part 2 of The New Panic Room, brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
And we're back. I hope you're back, Extina.
I am back, yes.
Oh, just in body, if not spirit. It's,
right.
Yes, so welcome back. That was all rather jolly again, deliberately avoiding the Christmas music, which I am going to have to wheel out next week because it's our... I guess our pre-Christmas show. So
yeah,
I look forward to that every year, as you know.
Yes, you do. You know, when I was getting up to cook on Thanksgiving morning, I was so excited because it was when I could break out my Christmas music. So I was
You are a monster. You're a monster. Really, you just shouldn't be allowed in public, to be honest.
I get so jolly, and I can't wait to put up the tree. And, you know, there's nothing better than sitting around your house in the, you know, evening, the no lights on, just the Christmas tree. It's just so magical, and I want that now. You know, you can pay people to put up your tree. I should do that.
Moving on. I don't like people in my, I don't even like the cleaners in my house, and that's just the way I am. I sort of hunker down in my office and work, and they don't do the office. I do it because I don't want them in here because this is my space. But I mean, it's great. It's nice having a clean house, but just having other people in the house is, I find it difficult.
Yeah. So, Colin, what about you? Are you ready for Christmas yet? Colin.
Oh, Colin. No, we're going to bring Colin back on. Oh. So you need to introduce him again. Do your job. Come on.
All right. Definitely. We have horror author Colin W. Sargent.
Woo! Hello again, Colin.
Hi, James.
Hello. I'm obviously doing better than next scene. You know, you think after 330 odd shows, she'd have got it right by now, but clearly not.
You would think.
Clearly not.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to do another 300 shows just so she can, you know, get anywhere near close. But she was going to ask you about Christmas, and I really do. The C word is banned in this house until December, so I refuse to discuss it. As one writer to another, I mean, who inspires you, Colin?
Well, I'm from Maine, so I'm sort of programmed into saying Stephen King. Something neat going on with a Portland magazine, my publishing business up here in Maine. We're a 38-year-old city magazine. We found a 1979 interview with Stephen King that was never published. And the reason is all of the Stephen King books that at the same time were either released or re-released because he had picked up some steam. And so at the same time on bestseller lists were things like The Dead Zone and Carrie and Salem's Lot. And so the person who wrote this was at an internship at the Indianapolis Star. He'd gone from Maine. And then he became a prominent attorney and legislator and sort of turned his back on writing. And now he's in his 60s. And he approached me because he'd watched the magazine Across Time and said, well, I have this this story. No one's ever seen it before. And it shows Stephen King and how impulsive and puckish he was before the auto accident. Not that he's not impulsive and puckish now. But he was careeningly so, wonderfully so, and you could see in the young man, you know, the portrait of the Horrormeister as a young man, you could see he had all the chops for what he's going to do in the future. And I read it, and I was suspicious of anything found like that, so I had to check to make sure everything was legitimate. And this is the real deal. It was like discovering a DeLorean. You know, from the 1980s in an old barn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I discovered King back in the late 70s, early 80s. That, for me, was a lot of his best stuff. Salem's Lot is my all-time favorite King book. I mean, I was just absolutely brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book. But all his early stuff, his short stories... I mean, Dead's a Firestarter, you know, not enough people talk about Firestarter. What a brilliant, brilliant book. Even with Christine, Dead Zone was brilliant, as you say, as well. Great, terrific.
I like Dead Zone, yeah. And so, you know, that kind of story, but also I watch a lot of TV and I watch a lot of movies. You were talking about Christmas music, and I was thinking of the old Alan Alda movie called Mephisto, where he's a pianist and you're taken into a really scary place in that show. Sometimes I like obscure stories. Like there was this one 50s movie where there's a pianist and he loves his hands. He fetishizes his hands, won't let anybody touch them. He goes around, it's most annoying. And then, you know, that's a big setup. So he's going to be in a car accident and his hands are chopped off. Mm. And then the movie just drops down into, for scary, I like to imagine things more than see them. In Jurassic Park, the part that scares me the most is the drop of water that goes across the coffee cup in waves or glass of water, rather than all the vulcanized rubber later of all the terrible lizards jumping around.
Right.
But, you know, my favorite part of Jurassic Park was when the Tyrannosaurus Rex ate that man on the toilet, which... To be fair, says a lot about me. Isn't that everyone's fear?
I'm really
you're sitting on the toilet thinking, I really, really hope I don't get eaten by a T-Rex while I'm sitting here. But it's funny. I mean, do you tend to gravitate to, you know, when you watch movies, watch TV, do you gravitate towards, you know, the horror, the dark stuff, or do you watch pretty much anything?
I think that any book or any story has to have a descent into the underworld to be a serious work. And even if it's, I think now when people go into a nightclub, even in a Perry Mason episode or something like that, and they go into the nightclub, that's the classic Dante-esque descent into the underworld. So yes, I love to have one step into the supernatural or one step beyond the known, because otherwise we're just shuffling around and we're in a work crew. I like things that we don't understand that are just sort of teasing us and beckoning us.
I like that. That's a very Lovecraftian way of looking at the world, isn't it? That there's, and it's something that appeals to me. I tend to gravitate towards in horror and stuff like that. But I will watch, you know, other stuff as well. But it's I think it's why I enjoy Clive Barker so much, is that idea of just beyond the thin veil of our reality, that there's a whole different dark, disturbing world, and I you know, that's what gets me going. That's really inspires me.
Yep. I like to see it in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I like Nathaniel Hawthorne. He said his definition for a romance is much different than what romance is today. You know, sometimes romance will be like a movie about falling in love in Naples or something like that on TV. But his idea of romance was it has to have some aspect of the supernatural for it to be truly romantic.
Well,
interesting.
I think we've talked about that.
I can get that, because I mean, the whole falling in love thing, one, speaking as a twice divorced man, can be incredibly horrific. But two, you know, and again, you look at the words that surround the whole thing, you know, if you fall under someone's spell, and immediately you're in the realm of the supernatural. You're talking about spells and feelings you can't understand and the effect that people have on that sort of thing. I think it's maybe it's not, certainly looking like the Hallmark movie, you know, these romance movies, not explored enough for me.
Right. And I have to deal with romance in that sense, because I'm from one of these old New England scary families where I'm descended from one of the jurors and judges from the Salem witch trials.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really?
How much
of
that has made it, how much of that has made it into me? And so actually the person who was murdered in the House of Seven Gables was based on a relative of mine. And my family in Salem, which is now like just a tourist attraction, but there is something truly spooky about Salem. Anyway, that was an ancestor of mine that lived in there. And so I think that things have been knocking at the door of my unconscious about how while people don't ever peg me to be a person who will see a ghost or see something other, I'm alert for it and sensitive to it all the time, and I think it's the basis of anything seriously worthwhile to read.
Well, that is amazing. I mean, you need to exploit that.
Yes,
that's quite an
yes.
ancestry, you know. That's impressive.
Yeah. Speaking of which, what are you working on now, Colin?
Okay. I actually have the same character, Hunter, years later, and his wife Pia is fried by a lightning strike, and so it draws patterns, the lightning strike, and this really happens to people who are stricken. Is it stricken by a lightning or struck? Anyway, gorgeous designs were made all over his body, and so he has to button his he never goes swimming unless he's wearing a t-shirt, and he wakes up 4 months later having forgotten everything that he knows. And so he starts driving and ends up being a Lyft driver going around the Grand Canyon. And so my working title for it is Grand Canyon Lyft. He's at the edge of all of these things, all of this, all of the supernatural, all his own sense of self. And slowly some things come back to him, but he learns a whole different set of things. He learned aviate, navigate, communicate, but there's a whole different, as a pilot. But now when he's been unpiloted, he has to completely reinvent himself. And that's the start of it. And the funny thing is that if anyone says anything disturbing or insulting or strange, I put it into my outline and see if it'll come back into it later, because
definitely.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, I hate to do this, but we are just about out of time for our show this evening. You have to promise to come back when you complete the next book so we can talk to you then. Yeah?
Fantastic. I'd love
Yay,
to.
Yay, awesome.
Happy holidays to everybody.
Thank
yeah,
you.
And to you. Absolutely. So yeah, before we go, just let us know where we can find you online, sir.
All right. Well, I have my website is colinsargent.com, and there's a special page devoted in that to New Flying Dark. People are having fun with it. And I am so grateful to Hellbound for sensing things in the manuscript that disqualify it in some worlds and then be celebrated where you are. And when I look at some of the titles in Hellbound, I'm just astonished at the amount of originality that I see. So I'm proud to be in your group.
Brilliant. Thank you. We're delighted to have you with us as well. But it is time to go, unfortunately. So, yeah, we will chat again. No problem at all with that. I will look forward to that. In the new year, almost the new year now. So, God, I'm depressed now. So, Colin, you have a wonderful rest of your evening, sir.
All right, you too. Take care.
Okay.
Good night.
And you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Well, that went by, or we say every time,
Yay.
Went by way too fast. What a fascinating guy. And a descendant
good.
Of
yeah.
the Salem
witch
trial.
Yeah.
On the other side of the... So, Yeah, well, again, we need to explore that next time we speak to Colin. See,
definitely.
See how much of that is stuck with him.
Right.
Right, and it's that time of night when I have to say goodnight, Xtina.
Good night, Xtina.
Good night.
Yeah. And now a public service announcement from Carolers Against Bad Gifts.
Tis the season to be lucky.
Lots of cash.
We would love a few scratch tickets.
Lots of cash.
I don't need a nose hair trimmer.
Lots of cash.
I could be the next big winner.
This season, give them what they really want. Give them holiday scratch tickets from the Texas Lottery. Must be 18 or older. Play responsibly.
We all know a guy who only occasionally shaves for big occasions, and it's because that occasional shave really hurts. It's the time of year for big occasions, and yet there he is, suffering with that cheap drugstore razor. Let's help him out. Henson Shaving's line of razors, built with aerospace precision, deliver a smooth shave your dad, brother, and even son can enjoy, eventually. With replacement blades just 10 cents each, you'll buy it once, and they'll use it for life. How's that for the perfect gift? Celebrate with 100 free blades on your first purchase, and no subscription headaches. HensonShaving.com/holiday.